Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much, Kate, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop. Today's program is titled Living the Challenge of MPN in the Workplace, How to Communicate with Your Employer, and this is part four of our Living with Myeloproliferative Neoplasm, or MPN series. So we have been doing this program now. This is our fourth program, and there'll be two more after this one. And we're delighted with your response to our program today. Today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations. And we also are collaborating with the MPN Education Foundation and the MPN Research Foundation as well, as well as the Leukemia Lymphoma Society, the Max Foundation, a number of other organizations that are really collaborating with us to make this program possible. Now, we have on the call today over 390 participants on the call, so there's a lot of you on the call today, and you come from all over the United States. And we also have international participants from Australia, Canada, the United Kingdom, and Venezuela. So you really come from all over the world, and it's really a credit to you that you've chosen to spend the next hour with us. Today's program and this entire series was made possible by the Insight Corporation. I really want to thank them for their support of this entire series. I would like to turn your attention for a moment to all the materials that you received from Cancer Care. In those materials is information about our speakers, about all of our different collaborating organizations. We also have information, and that information is useful to you as a resource so that you can use that information as you have concerns and questions. They each have different resources to offer you, and they're all free services. And there also is an evaluation form, and I would ask you at the end of today's program to complete the evaluation form. You know, your feedback is critically important to us as we plan future programs. The comments that you make to us, your suggestions for topics, we take them very seriously. Indeed, this entire series was based on many of your writing to us when we've done some MPN series before in which you'd said you'd like these particular topics to be addressed. So we really listen to you. And again, we're planning many programs for this year, so the timing could not be better for you to tell us what you would like us to do. Now, we have wonderful speakers today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker for today. And our first speaker today is Dr. Michael Morrow. And Dr. Morrow is leader of Myeloproliferative Diseases Program, member of Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, professor Weill Cornell Medical College, New York Presbyterian Hospital. And Dr. Morrow is going to address an overview of MPN. He's going to discuss managing your treatment for MPN while working, and advances in side effect management. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Morrow.
Thank you, Carolyn, and thank you all for joining. I realize you may be expecting Dr. Ruben Mesa rather than myself, and I'm glad to join in and perhaps offer my insights. Dr. Mesa works tirelessly in the field of MPNs, and is a friend and colleague, and I'm sure he wishes he could be here today. So, starting with an overview of MPNs, clearly we have one of the less common hematologic disorders, but I imagine many of you on the call are quite interested, maybe affected yourselves or have a loved one. But these are a group of unique and somewhat more rare blood diseases that fall into a family or group that are called myeloproliferative disorders. The main diseases we're talking about are a quadrat of four diseases of chronic myeloid leukemia, or CML, polycythemia vera, or PV, essential thrombocytosis, or ET, and myelofibrosis, or MF. There are other diseases which are often included in myeloproliferative disorders, generally similar conditions of overproduction of blood cells, such as eosinophils and mast cells, even neutrophils, or which are mature white blood cells. So there are even less common and similar conditions. But there's a clear commonality between these, which are overproduction conditions of the bone marrow. Each generally focuses on a cell line, with CML being an overproduction of white blood cells and platelets, polycythemia overproduction of red blood cells, ET overproduction of platelets, and myelofibrosis a bit of a hybrid where there's overproduction of platelet-forming cells as often a start, or as a, or sometimes an overproduction of red blood cells, but a phenomenon where the marrow becomes a less friendly place for blood production to occur, and there's scarring or fibrosis with ensuing changes in the body where the blood is trying to be made elsewhere, and there are symptoms and problems along with it. And I think that may be some of the areas we focus on, which would be MF, which is a common part of many of the myeloproliferative disorders, and is a later stage or a natural history, something that often evolves from the two of the other diseases called PV and ET. We have excellent treatments for myeloproliferative disorders. We've come a long way, and part of that has really been the unraveling of the genome and understanding of the molecular drivers or the fingerprints or the signatures of these conditions. Clearly in CML, which may be the subject of an entire teleconference, we have identified the Philadelphia chromosome and an abnormality called BCR-ABL fusion, which is targetable and treatable with an orally available agents. We have a family of agents, starting with Gleevec and moving through to Cigna, Sprycel, Bosulif, and Iclusig, all drugs approved for the use in CML, even the first or subsequent lines of treatment. And we have very high success rates with the ability to bring people into blood and bone marrow remission at very high rates, and upwards of 90% in chronic phase for even any of the first three agents I talked about. And a very successful ability to rescue someone who doesn't achieve remission or who loses remission. We think of CML as a maintenance treatment right now, where people stay on their initial therapy. And really, in 2014, it's a careful navigation of choosing the right initial therapy, managing side effects, including managing side effects at the workplace, and achieving milestones of response with early reduction in CML by blood-based testing at 3 months, and either blood or marrow-based testing, but often it can be blood-based testing at 6 to 12 months. And within a year to two, we generally see the patients often, again, the overwhelming majority will achieve a deep level of remission where it's a full blood and bone marrow remission, even a molecular remission is what we aim for. And the research currently in CML is focusing on addressing any patients who have difficulty with symptoms or side effects or resistance, and whether we may be able to see remissions lasting without sustained therapy, what we call a functional cure. Moving on to the other myeloproliferative disorders, there was a major advance with the molecular characterization of the remaining conditions by the identification of the JAK2 or Janus kinase type 2 alteration or mutation. This is felt to be a driver or a main switch that is abnormal in myeloproliferative disorders across the board, and the targeted therapy called ruxolitinib was the first of a family likely of compounds which will be hopefully available in the near future to treat this disease. What's happening here is we have, like BCR-ABL, we have a subtle alteration in a main driver or control area. In CML, it's controlling proliferation and response to signals to have blood cells senesce or die, and they basically don't do that, and we have overproduction and persistence of white blood cells and platelet-forming cells. And in myelofibrosis, polycythemia, and essential thrombocytosis, we have the Janus 2 kinase present in probably half on average of those conditions, or similar pathways activated in probably the majority of cases. Very recently, we've seen characterization of a second mutation called calreticulin, which is probably the basis or the more subtle switch that may be activating the same pathways, but it characterizes those patients who do not have a JAK2 kinase abnormality. Ruxolitinib as a primary or as an initial therapy for patients with higher risk myelofibrosis can make tremendous improvements in quality of life, symptoms such as reducing spleen size and decreasing some of the main problems people face, which are symptoms like weight loss and fatigue and flu-like symptoms. And some of the more careful nuances we've developed over the last few years have been titration of dosing of ruxolitinib, knowing that it's a drug that can be tailored and fit well to each patient, modifying the dose. Because one of the main side effects can be, as we're affecting the blood as a primary organ, a target organ, we sometimes see correction of the blood to a degree and sometimes suppression of blood production because of the natural effect of targeting the JAK2 kinase, which is a control switch for blood production, essentially. I want to focus in the last few minutes on what it means to have these conditions and what it might mean in the workplace, as my colleagues are going to get into that. I talked to a lot of patients with MPNs or myeloproliferative disorders, and this is a challenge. Is these are serious conditions. They're blood conditions. They are blood cancers. We often have to work around that term because as indolent or slow-moving as they can be and as chronic as their nature is and actually how good our treatments are with often our ability to make tremendous improvements in outcome, they are serious and require serious treatment. So the conditions themselves have side effects which can affect one's daily life. I mentioned with myelofibrosis, fatigue, flu-like symptoms, weight loss, really a significant loss of energy. Enlargement of the spleen, which is in the abdomen on the left side, which can cause symptoms and difficulty with eating, with movement, with activity, et cetera. Patients with CML can have symptoms such as fatigue, similar enlargement in the spleen, fevers. Anemia is a common condition for both CML and myelofibrosis and can occur with treatment of any of the myeloproliferative disorders as a common side effect. Anemia is a significant symptom which can affect work, concentration, energy, focus. And there's a paradox in that the treatment or the diseases themselves don't have a lot of outward manifestations, meaning that someone may not look very different who has a myeloproliferative disorder and hasn't been treated. But on the inside, they can feel quite rough. And it can be quite a challenge. Treatment itself can bring on side effects, although generally all of the targeted therapies I've talked about have a limited range of side effects. But I know that's a challenge for people to face, that they may have a serious condition with side effects in and of itself in the condition, sometimes side effects from treatment. TKI treatments for CML often have side effects that are bothersome, such as muscle cramps, diarrhea, fluid retention, et cetera, rash, things that can be outwardly manifest but often not. And explaining to people that you have a serious condition and you're symptomatic when you may not look like someone who has cancer or someone who needs treatment for a serious condition. I'm so proud of my patients that they're able to work and push through, if you will, the disease, the side effects. And it's very important to help people understand how to best manage their side effects, how to inform their friends and family and loved ones and even their members of their workplace when appropriate and how it's best appropriate. I think we'll get advice on that shortly in order to best manage. We've made tremendous strides in improving side effects really by understanding our medications better. We have a long experience with Gleevec, for example, over 10 years of experience, and we know to carefully monitor for side effects and to switch therapy or to modify the dose or to bring in supportive care where needed and to set our goals appropriately. We've learned a lot about ruxolitinib and how to adjust the dose and to modify some of the side effects which can occur. But fortunately, these drugs themselves relieve many of the disease-related complications and don't bring on a great burden of side effects themselves. So we're mainly dealing with the diseases themselves. I'm going to perhaps curtail the rest of my comments and leave time for others. And I appreciate the time and the ability to speak to you about this important advances we've made and really how to manage these side effects, especially while you continue to live life, which I hope everyone can.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Moore. That's wonderful. Excellent presentation. And I know there will be questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you. And our next speaker is Deborah Wolf, and Deborah Wolf is an attorney. She's senior attorney, Legal Health, New York Legal Assistance Group, NILAC. And Ms. Wolf is going to address understanding your legal rights in the workplace, and including the Americans with Disabilities Act, ADA, Family Medical Leave Act, FMLA, and Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, EEOC, as well as disclosure and communication with coworkers and supervisors. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Ms. Wolf, who actually, I must say, feels like she's like our resident legal expert here because she really presents a great deal on both this topic and on the Affordable Care Act. So I'm very delighted to have you here today.
Deborah? Thanks so much, Dr. Messner. I'm happy to be a part of this teleconference to talk about legal protections in the workplace. I'm going to give an overview of the laws that protect people while still working and also if they need to take a medical leave. And I'll also talk about what to do if you believe you're being discriminated against in the workplace. Now, my focus today will be on federal laws that apply to all 50 states, but I do urge everyone listening to also become familiar with your state laws as they often expand on the federal laws, and I'll give some examples as we go forward. Before I review the applicable laws, I also want to urge everyone, if you are working, to make sure to review the specific medical leave policies of your employer. Every employer should provide either an employee handbook or a summary of company policies and benefits. And these policies must comply with the laws I'll be discussing, but in some circumstances may even offer a greater leave policy or greater benefit. So it's important to know your individual employer policies. I'm going to begin with a law I'm sure most of you have heard of, the Americans with Disabilities Act, or is often called the ADA. This is a federal law that again applies to all 50 states, to everyone who works for an employer with 15 or more employees. To be eligible for protection under the ADA, you must have a disability, which is defined as having an impairment as a result of your diagnosis that substantially limits a major life activity. Cancer will be covered if, as a result, it limits major life activities such as walking, working, eating, or sleeping. And the ADA was recently amended to give a much broader definition of what is considered a disability. It includes illnesses that have gone into remission, and as a result, cancer is covered under the law as a qualified disability in most cases. Now, the ADA has two main benefits. The first benefit is that it requires an employer to make reasonable accommodations when requested by an employee. This allows an employee to go to human resources or their boss if there is no HR and request a modification of their work schedule, work environment, or company policies such as lunch breaks. What is reasonable is determined on a case-by-case basis, but an employer must grant the request unless it creates an undue hardship, which is a really tough burden for an employer to establish, and even an extra cost is not always an undue burden. So some common accommodations that I've helped people set up include the following: a later work start time due to side effects of medication or illness, a shorter work day, or an extra break during the day. I recently assisted a writer set up a schedule that allowed her to work from home 3 days a week, but it's important to remember that you have to be able to do the essential functions of your job with the accommodation, so working from home may not always be an option for everyone. A job transfer to a less strenuous position can also be an accommodation, but if there are others waiting in line for this same position, the person requesting the accommodation does not get priority status for the job. They have to wait in line like everybody else. The employer can't refuse an accommodation, but they can negotiate. They can perhaps say, I'm not sure this will work for us, but let's talk about what's going to work for both of us. It must be what's called an interactive process or a discussion. Now, the employee must request the accommodation, and generally the employer is not allowed to ask if an employee is disabled or needs an accommodation. This puts the burden on the employee to come forward, and it's important to do this if you feel that your illness or treatment is impacting your work. We'll talk a little later about the EEOC, but an employee may have a legal claim against their employer if they refuse to approve a reasonable accommodation, but only if the accommodation is requested and the employer is aware of the disability. I always suggest that the accommodation request should be made in writing with a letter of support from your doctor certifying that you can do the essential functions of your job and that the accommodation is medically necessary. I also always suggest that this be done through human resources or, if no HR, someone in your office with knowledge of employee rights. The second ADA benefit is that the law prohibits discrimination against an employee because of a disability or perceived disability. So this includes any adverse action in hiring, firing, demoting, or harassment. Also, if a person is able to do their job and has an accommodation in place or needs time off, an employer can't take action that adversely affects their job, such as termination or demotion. Sometimes people see their duties shift after an accommodation request, and we'll talk a bit more about discrimination in the workplace shortly. The next law I want to discuss is the Family Medical Leave Act, often called FMLA. FMLA applies to employers with 50 or more employees, and to be covered, you must have worked at your job for 12 months for 1,250 hours in the last year. I think that averages out to probably around 30 hours per week. If an employee qualifies, they're entitled to 12 weeks of job-protected leave for every 12-month period. This is unpaid leave, but can be supplemented with sick time or short-term disability, which is often a benefit offered and is required in 5 states. Employee benefits such as health insurance must continue, although employees must continue to pay on any contribution they make for the premiums. FMLA also allows for what's called intermittent leave, which may include a few hours a week for treatment or for a doctor visit. So as an example, an employee can request FMLA leave every other Thursday afternoon and Friday for treatment if all your sick time is used up, and your job will be protected for up to 12 weeks worth of time. So this is an excellent benefit for someone who's used all their sick time and is worried about losing their job or perhaps being threatened by a supervisor for excess absences. Also check your state laws, as many states now have paid or protected leave policies even if you don't qualify for FMLA. Now, with the Americans with Disabilities Act, a person can only request the benefits such as accommodations for yourself. But under FMLA, time off can be requested to care for yourself or a family member, such as a spouse or child. If your FMLA-protected time off is used up and you think you may be able to return to work shortly or need some additional time off, this can be requested as a reasonable accommodation under the ADA. And also, if you work for a smaller company and don't qualify for FMLA, time off can be requested as a reasonable accommodation and be protected as well. Now, the request must be reasonable, and there are no clear guidelines, and what is reasonable is determined on a case-by-case basis. Now, I also want to briefly discuss disclosure under the ADA and FMLA, and as it relates to discrimination. Disclosure is a personal choice, and you have the right to determine to who and under what circumstances you want to disclose your health issues. And I always urge caution when disclosing to coworkers and supervisors. Now, with the ADA, there are 3 distinct disclosure phases. The first is pre-employment, or while someone is applying for or interviewing for a job. And during this period, employers cannot ask any direct health or disability questions. They cannot ask you if you're disabled, although they are able to ask if you can perform the duties of your job with or without a reasonable accommodation. But an employer can't require you to take a medical examination before you're offered a job. Now, the next phase is with a pre-employment job offer. Following a job offer, an employer can condition that offer on your passing a required medical examination, but only if all entering employees for that job category have to take the same examination. So, in other words, certain people can't be singled out. During this period, employers may ask you to complete medical questionnaires or have a medical exam, and you must be truthful in responding. However, an employer can't revoke a job offer because of information about your illness revealed by the medical examination, and as long as you can perform the essential functions of your job, again, with or without an accommodation. But they can renege on the job offer if you provide false information during this phase. So truthfulness at this stage is always very important. Once you're working, your employer cannot require that you take a medical examination or ask questions about your disability unless they're job-related and necessary for the conduct of your employer's business. employees in jobs that involve public safety, such as a firefighter or bus driver, may have more job-related inquiries than, say, someone who works in an office. So my general advice is generally only disclose when required, and this would be if you need an accommodation under the Americans with Disabilities Act or time off under FMLA. Often, coworkers and supervisors are not your friends, and they become concerned about how your illness will affect their own job performance, such as a supervisor who needs to make sure you complete a certain project or make a quota if you work in sales. If you must disclose for an accommodation or for FMLA leave, go to Human Resources if you can, as they understand these laws that protect you, and many supervisors do not. I also suggest you include a medical letter of support from your doctor that states you're able to do the essential functions of your job, which gives you the protections under the Americans with Disabilities Act against any discrimination. Any medical letter you provide to support your request must remain confidential and in a separate file outside of your employee file. And it should be available only on a need-to-know basis. So if your supervisor wants to see your personnel file to look at, let's say, past performance reviews, no medical information should be contained in that file. Now, even with these laws of protection, discrimination does exist. Often fellow employees and even supervisors and managers don't understand these laws and what their responsibilities are. Often an employee will ask their supervisor for an accommodation, and the reply is, oh, we don't do that here, or that's not possible, because they don't understand their responsibilities under these laws. If someone is working and believes they're being discriminated against, they should first try to resolve through Human Resources. HR employees are trained in these laws and should understand your rights and try to help you resolve. Because, again, your supervisor may not have any understanding of your rights and their responsibilities. If the concern remains unresolved, a person can file a complaint with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, or EEOC, which is an organization that enforces the Americans with Disabilities Act. An EEOC complaint generally must be filed within 180 days of the Act, or the Act of Discrimination, but varies by state law. So a person should act quickly. The EEOC will investigate the complaint to determine if it has merit and may conduct a hearing if they believe there was discrimination. They can also issue a right to sue letter so you can file a court case. An EEOC complaint and this right to sue letter are required before filing a lawsuit for discrimination under the ADA. If you file a lawsuit without your right to sue letter, it will be dismissed. Now, this is one area in which I again suggest you check your state laws. For example, in New York, where I practice, our city and state human rights laws mirror the ADA, including reasonable accommodations and prohibitions against discrimination, but apply to employers with four or more employees, so it offers protection to a broader group of people. If you feel there is discrimination, I also urge you to talk to a lawyer before taking any legal steps so that you fully understand both your rights and responsibilities. So I want to end with a summary of what I've discussed. First, understand your benefits, read your summary of benefits, and also make sure you understand your employer's medical leave policy. And as I said, many employers, and especially if you have a union, offer more generous time off policies than under FMLA. Second, use Human Resources or talk to an attorney if you feel you're being discriminated against. Be proactive to avoid any adverse action as a result of the discrimination. Coworkers and supervisors often have to be educated about the laws we discussed, and that's the role of Human Resources. Third, think about any ADA accommodations that might help you in your job and seek a letter of medical support from your doctor. There's no set list of accommodations. It's really what's reasonable under the circumstances and decided on a case-by-case basis. And then finally, think carefully of who you might disclose to. I do have to say that I speak to many people who are working through their illness and their treatment, who have employers and coworkers who are incredibly supportive. So I don't want to leave you with the impression that there are always problems, because as I said, oftentimes employers can be very helpful and very supportive. But it's up to the individual to decide if disclosure is needed, and I just urge everyone to think it through and do what's best for them. I know this is a lot of information, and I encourage listeners to take the time to educate themselves about these laws and their state laws that do offer protection, and seek out resources such as Cancer Care to have a better understanding of their rights and responsibilities. There's also a National Cancer Legal Service Network and I'll give you the website, nclsn.org. And this is a website you can use to find attorneys like myself who offer free legal services to people with cancer throughout the United States. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. That's excellent. And Deborah, could you repeat that one more time, the website, so everyone can have that? I'm sure people are wanting to have that again.
Of course. It's nclsn.org, and that stands for National Cancer Legal Service Network.
Perfect. That's a wonderful resource, and we will be sure that everyone has that information. We'll remind everyone about that. It's a wonderful resource to access. Thank you. And thank you for that excellent presentation. I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well, and thank you as always. And our next speaker is Dr. Stuart Fleischman. And Dr. Fleischman is Founding Director, Cancer Support Services, Continuum Cancer Centers of New York. He's Accreditation Surveyor, American College of Surgeons, Commission on Cancer. And Dr. Fleischman is going to address talking with your healthcare team about your work and its role in your life, practical solutions to address workplace challenges, and tips for creating a plan to continue working. It's really my pleasure now to bring on Dr. Fleischman, who is a frequent presenter on these programs and is always addressing many of the issues that people struggle with in their day-to-day lives in coping with cancer with MPN. So it's my pleasure to have Dr. Fleischman on the call.
Thank you, Dr. Messner, and thank you, everybody. I'll try to put a bit of a practical tie together on a lot of the information that's been presented, good information. In my career, I've been both an employee and an employer, so I understand how the workplace needs to accommodate. But my advice is that if you need to have one of those discussions, if you go in with information like you've been given now, plus at least a partial solution to the problem, it makes it more likely that things are going to happen rather than leave it to a supervisor who may be overburdened to have to solve the problem as well. So what we've heard is that this set of diseases has a variety of quality of life effects, side effects, and the treatments have some quality of life side effects. And what you need to do is to actually figure out which of those are going to impact on your daily routine. We spoke a little bit about the work day, but probably you need to think a little more globally, which is what you need to do to get to work, what you need to do to get home, because that may impact on your ability to function during your treatment. So as far as what we heard, there's a variety of side effects like fatigue, flu-like symptoms, maybe enlargement in the abdomen, splenic enlargement, anemia, which may affect your activity level, your body's flexibility, as well as your exercise tolerance. So think about if you need to have one of these discussions with your employer and human resources representative, depending upon the kind of place that you work in, think about what you need to do to get yourself to work. Are you traveling in a car? If you have splenic enlargement, it may be hard to sit behind the wheel, and many cars don't have seats that adjust so well. Do you need to go in public transportation? Are there people who are going to be sniffling and sneezing and coughing in the area, or can you travel at a time when the public transportation is less crowded? As we heard before, one of the things you may be able to do is adjust your start and end time so that you're not in the middle of crowds. How long do you have to walk to get from a parking lot or to the bus or to the train? Think about all those things. And then when you think about in your regular average day the kinds of activities you need to do with work, is it a sedentary or a sitting job? A lot of time at the computer. Do you need to be up and about and have lots of mobility and lots of energy to be able to carry out the functions of your day? If you think through those sorts of things and then speak with your healthcare team about the kinds of things that could be expected, not necessarily destiny to that will happen to you, but the kinds of things that can be expected, together, you can figure out if the expected side effects may have the possibility of impacting your role at work, getting to work, your role during the day, and getting home from work. So, for example, some of the newer targeted therapies for cancer treatment sometimes give a skin reaction. If you're the person working at the front desk, that may not be the best place for you. You may feel self-conscious. Being there, it may be that you need to be more in a back office where there's a little less public exposure. Again, think through the kinds of things that you need to be able to do to get to work during your workday and afterwards to be able to figure out what kind of accommodation could be needed. The adjustment of work time is obvious. Time off for appointments is obvious. And that's been discussed before. So I think those are the things that you really need to be able to put together to make a plan. I remember a number of years ago with a patient who had the kind of chemotherapy before some of the newer treatments that lowered our resistance to infection. Was a kindergarten teacher, and she loved to go to work. She really wanted to work all through her treatment. She needed to work because she needed to maintain her medical insurance to help reimburse for her treatment, but she was afraid of being around kids who were sniffling all day and who didn't know to sneeze into their elbows the way adults are trained. And a number of accommodation steps needed to be done to make that possible, but she was able to negotiate with her employer. Again, I don't have any data on this, but my experience is that if your employer has had cancer or if someone high up in your organization has had cancer or had a relative who's had cancer, people are a lot more accommodating in understanding what you need. Again, no data, just sort of an observation over many years of practice that seems to be a logical pattern in figuring out how flexible your workplace is going to be. So I'm going to stop there, and then we'll have more questions later. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Fleischman. Excellent presentation, as always, addressing some of the key issues that people address in the workplace. And now I'd like to introduce Sarah Kelly. Sarah is an oncology social worker, and she's coordinator of older adult services here at Cancer Care. And she's going to address the free psychosocial support services offered by Cancer Care, as well as the role of support groups. It's now my pleasure to bring on Ms. Kelly.
Thank you, Dr. Messner. And as Dr. Messner said, I'm an oncology social worker here, and I work with many people who are coping with MPN and also their loved ones. And we've really been talking today about navigating your care, finding different ways to manage that care. I liked when Dr. Fleischman talked about making a plan. And what I want to talk to you about is how creating a support network can be part of that plan and part of that care, and how cancer care can also be a part of that with you. So just a little about who we are. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization that provides free professional support services to anyone affected by cancer. Our programs include individual counseling. We provide that face-to-face in the New York area and then over the telephone nationally. We have support groups, which we also provide face-to-face in New York, over the phone nationally. We also have an online group program that we do nationally and internationally. We have education programs like the one we're on today. We also provide practical help and how to navigate the healthcare system. And then in addition to that, we have some financial assistance as well as chemotherapy copay assistance. All of our services are provided by licensed master's level oncology social workers, and they're completely free of charge. oncology social workers really are trained in how a diagnosis of cancer affects a person in his or her support network and family and friends. We're also trained to help cancer patients and their families tackle the problems that accompany the disease, financial demands, physical changes, social adjustments, psychological impact, really the quality of life issues we've been talking about on the call today. And I think adjusting to and finding ways of navigating all of this is really an important part of the healing process. So as you all know, cancer affects the whole person. You know, we've been talking a lot today just about the different aspects of life that cancer can affect. Asking someone for help by joining a support group, contacting a social worker, really is a sign of strength. And that's what I want you to take with you from my talk today, really that you don't have to do this alone. Joining a support group, you really can connect with others who are going through a similar situation or having similar problems. With individual counseling, you have a space that's just yours to voice some of the concerns that are coming up. And I think the connections help lessen the isolation that can happen when you're experiencing cancer. Feeling well emotionally helps you better deal with the diagnosis and treatment. So I'm going to talk a little about our services. As I mentioned, you know, we have groups and workshops and individual counseling. I also wanted to talk about an online support group we have going on now for anyone diagnosed with a blood cancer. If you're interested at all in registering for that, you're just going to go to our website, which is cancercare.org. And I believe you guys have that in your packets. But know that if you want to register, you can go there. We also provide individual counseling for patients who are diagnosed with blood cancer and their caregivers. Again, it's face-to-face in the New York City area and then over the phone nationally. If you're interested in any of these services, call us. And then just to finish and wrap up, I want to say that, you know, we've gotten a lot from today's program. It's a lot of information to digest and a lot to get your arms around. And we're really here to help you understand what it means for you and for your loved ones. So if you have questions, you know, if today's workshop has really sort of sparked some new ideas or questions you may have, please, please call us. You know, that's what we're here for. And I really want you to remember that you're not alone in this. Cancer Care Services are here to help you. Thanks for your attention and the opportunity to talk.
Oh, well, thank you, you know, so much, Sarah. That's a really wonderful presentation about our services. And now we do have time for questions. We actually have lots of time for questions. And so I'm going to ask Kate to explain to all of you how to queue up for questions. And we're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. Now, if for some reason we're not able to get to your question, please do call our 800 number, 1-800-813-HOPE. And our staff, of course, are here to answer your questions. But let's see if we can take most of your questions now. Kate?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then 1 on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. And again, ladies and gentlemen, if you do have a question at this time, please press star, then 1 on your touch-tone telephone.
So there's a question from one of our online participants, and the question is, how do I approach my absence from the workforce due to cancer treatments, due to my MPAN treatments, in my resume and job interviews? So, Deborah, do you want to start with that?
Sure. You know, this question comes up a lot, and if you're talking about future absences or the need to take time off for a prospective job, my suggestion is usually that you don't discuss that in the job interview phase. As I said before, employers can't make inquiry about any disability or health issues. And I think the much better route to take is to interview for the job, not talk at the interview about the fact that there may be time off that you need because of health issues. But then once you have the job, as is your legal right, to go forward and say, I can do this job, but there are some accommodations that I'm going to need. And that might be intermittent time off for medical appointments. Remember, FMLA doesn't apply here because you have to have been working at your job for a year, but you're still protected under the Americans with Disabilities Act if you do need to take time off while you're working for doctor's appointments.
Excellent. And Stu, is there any ideas in terms of just the, for someone who's actually looking for a job, but in terms of their resume, perhaps they have a gap in their work history or something like that and are concerned that it might be a red flag for an employer, a potential employer?
Well, it's a good question, probably without a great answer, because no one wants to be caught misrepresenting or lying on a job application, because that can come back to haunt you as far as fraud. But if you do put down that you've been out for cancer treatment, people may get frightened. So it's a really, really, really hard question. I'm generally in favor of being as honest and open as possible, but you don't want to be too honest and too open. If there's some other way that you can account for that time as independent work or consultancy or whatever, that may be a better way without lying, so that you're not condemned before you even get your foot in the door.
That's an excellent point, that you actually, people do sometimes have gaps in their resume. Also, some people do not do a chronologic resume. They may do a resume that's based on what their expertise is and listing some of the places they've worked, but not put the dates that would then be, would be a kind of a red flag that there's been a space of time.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
So kind of that... and Sarah, any thoughts from the groups and things like that that you've experienced with people experiencing this?
Yeah, so just a few things about it. So the way that you do the resume, I think, is also a great point, Carolyn, that you said about not necessarily doing it chronologically and really sort of enhancing just your areas of expertise. I think that's a good way of doing it. And to Dr. Fleischman's point, definitely, definitely, you know, you don't want to lie, because that absolutely can come back as a fraud issue. And it actually creates a lot of stress from what I've heard from different clients I've worked with. So it's, you know, you don't want to do that. You do want to be as honest as possible with it. But there are ways that you can talk about that time off. It doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be disclosing what happened.
We kind of assume that everyone does have this kind of consistent, always work history. People do take time in and out of work. Also, particularly now with the way the labor force is, we often recommend, too, that this would be a wonderful time to have a discussion with an oncology social worker, with someone in your healthcare team about really putting that together and having someone help you with that, really thinking it through. And actually, you know, almost going through different drafts of it with somebody that is expert at that, helping you to really go through that. And many of the organizations, in addition to Cancer Care that we collaborate with, also are helpful in that respect. So you want to have as many people that you trust look at this before you actually send it out right away. And it doesn't have to take a lot of time. It might just take a little bit of reformatting of what you usually do. And so we want to really encourage you to... we do encourage people, actually, as much as possible to remain in the workforce. That's really important. And for anyone who's had and many people have spaces of time in the workforce. There are very creative ways of putting together resumes that really are, people are really looking for skill sets and what you actually know and can do. And also looking for some name recognition or where you've worked in the past as well. That's often very helpful as well. So I hope that helps, and but definitely that would be a good thing to follow up with one of our staff here so that you're not just left with, okay, so now how do I put this together? Yeah, that's really important. And we have another question from one of our online participants. The question is, given my competitive workplace coupled with my desire to move up in my company, I do not want to tell my boss about my recent diagnoses, but do not want to appear to be an employee that suddenly has an irregular attendance. What do you suggest is the best action? Deborah, would you like to start with that one in terms of...
Sure. And I think, again, this is... it's really on a case-by-case basis in terms of what your work environment is like and how much absence there will be. You know, some workplaces will tolerate occasional absences for doctor's appointments or whatever, and certainly everybody has some paid sick time. I think the concern is when you use up your sick time and you start needing to take more time off. You know, some people have a relationship with their supervisor where they can do this informally and say, you know what, I'm going to be out Thursday afternoon for an appointment. But I think others need to think about using the laws such as FMLA to protect themselves if they need to take time off. Because there is confidentiality, if somebody goes to HR and they apply for FMLA or apply for an accommodation, that information should not be disclosed to other people in the workplace. HR can certainly go to your supervisor and say, you know, this person has, you know, the right to take intermittent leave or have accommodation set up and this is what the accommodation is, but should not be disclosing your, you know, your health information. But other than saying it's got to be on a case-by-case basis in terms of how lenient your employer is, you know, just remember that you do have these laws as a backup to protect you.
Excellent. And they really are so important, that legal piece. And I think the point you've made is that it's the confidentiality. And I think that increasingly we are seeing that workforces, I think as Dr. Fleischman had said, are people have these experiences themselves with their family, and that it actually is impacting people's responsiveness to the, well, to the actual, the federal laws that exist as well that are mandates. But Dr.
If I could just add one more quick thing, and that is, you know, as I said before, with the Americans with Disabilities Act, the burden is on the employee. So if somebody doesn't come forward and ask for an accommodation, which could include time off for doctor's appointments, they're not protected. So if somebody is, you know, is fired for taking off too much time, but never requested an accommodation, they can't come back and say, well, this is discrimination because I'm a person who's protected. You have to assert those protections. So, you know, the burden is on the employee to come forward. So, you know, something to remember, because you're more protected sometimes if you do disclose.
That is such an important point, that that a pattern of just, as I think you pointed out, irregular attendance without any explanation is more complex for someone and much more difficult in a competitive work environment than actually confidentially speaking with the HR department and your supervisor about your particular needs and invoking the FMLA protection. And
Excellent.
And Sarah and Dr. Fleischman, do you want to add anything in terms of just your own experience with this or clinically, Sarah, in terms of our groups, in terms of people, how they've been able to deal with this?
Well, I think... go ahead.
I'm sorry. As one thing, in my experience, disclosure isn't necessarily a one-step process. If you need to say, I'm sick, and then not say any more until it's done through the proper channels, that may tip somebody off that you plan to invoke the laws that protect you, both from the feds and from the state and your employer. You don't need to say everything all at once, and then say give the details to the right people under the right circumstances.
Thank you. And Sarah?
Yeah, I was just going to say, and I think this is actually just going along with what Dr. Fleischman said, but, you know, in terms of the disclosure, you do want to be careful about what you're saying and who you're saying it to, and you also want to figure out, and this is, again, it is very case by case, as Ms. Wolf was saying, but you want to sort of figure out, and you may know this because you know your work environment, you know, what are some ways that you can work around this? I know people become very concerned about being out of the office more, if they're not there every day, if their face isn't there, you know, are the dynamics going to change? Is work going to be taken away? That type of thing. So figuring out ways to stay connected, even if physically you can't be there.
Well, that's a very good point, actually. Even if one does take some time off, that one actually does want to keep very much in touch. That's an excellent point, to be very present in many ways. That's important. Well, there is a question, actually, for Dr. Moore about Jakafee. I wonder if you could just say a bit about it. Just a general question from one of our online participants, just about how does it work, what is it, and I know you've said something about it, but if you could just say a word about it, that would be helpful again.
Absolutely. So Jakafee, or ruxolitinib, which is the generic name for it, is an FDA-approved oral medication for patients with higher risk myelofibrosis. It It works by inhibiting probably a family of enzymes called the JAK or Janus II kinase enzymes, which we know commonly in myeloproliferative disorders, there's a point mutation or an alteration in the in the DNA or the blueprints for that enzyme, and that makes that enzyme activate itself without a signal. So a targeted drug like ruxolitinib or Jakafi works by inhibiting that enzyme, which we think activation of that and probably the things in cells that respond to signals from something like a master switch, like the Janus kinase, they tell cells how much blood production to elicit, and there's a lot of regulatory signals. So essentially think of the medication as shutting off a switch that's been stuck on, and the switch should normally be able to, like a light switch should be able to be turned on and off, and if it's stuck on, you turn it off. And I say off because that in a cancer cell or a myeloproliferative disease-related cell, we want to hopefully see that cell then exit and clear and no longer be part of the marrow and the blood. It's a little hard to sometimes avoid complete selectivity and not just shutting down or slowing down some of the signaling or activity in other blood cells. And some of the main side effects is sometimes overcorrection of the blood or a reduction in the blood counts, anemia or low red blood count, and thrombocytopenia or low platelets. So that's the first and a fantastic example of what we can do in MF, and there are other Janus II or JAK kinase inhibitor medications in clinical development, amongst other medications in study for MPNs.
And also, just because the questions have come up, and I realize you have been probably treating so many patients with these issues, how what is your experience with your patients in the workforce in terms of, you know, continuing to work, workplaces being responsive? We did say it's a case by case basis, but just in general, just an observation on your part in terms of because I know you're often people might want to know from their physician, just explaining briefly in a sentence what, you know, why they're requesting this. What has been your experience with this in general?
I think we heard a fantastic assistance today from all of us, so my colleagues on the call, about seeking the right counsel and approaching this in the right way. Again, hopefully based on the notion that these are serious conditions and need the right people need the right support and the right approach. I try to be very optimistic that I tell people that to, you know, hope for the best and plan for the best, that work and function can hopefully be improved and sustained, and it's often for the long term or really the foreseeable future, but to make accommodations for the fact that things might not be rapidly improved, there may be side effects or pitfalls, and there may not be long-term success with the first treatment. We may need to move on to other treatments. We didn't talk in breath about some of the other treatments, but other things might be more challenging. They might be infusional medications that are done in the office, which can take someone away from their work. They may even be the right patient. Sometimes allogeneic stem cell transplantation or bone marrow transplant really is the right direction to go, and even for myeloproliferative disorders. And that's an entirely different conversation, because that takes someone away from their work and it really makes them tethered to the healthcare their providers for an extended period of time. So I think accessing therapy and getting the right accommodations you need needs to be done quickly and properly, and hopefully both coworkers, family, friends, and employers are understanding, and everything can fall into place. And then constantly updating and being proactive for oneself and to get what you need.
And that's really important. I think I really want to encourage everyone that this, I want to thank our speakers. It's been a wonderful group of speakers. I want to thank all of you who really posted such amazing questions. And clearly in an hour, we could give you some information, but there's so much more that, as we said, case by case, individually, that you would want to get help with. And so I don't want to leave you as the call begins to close with a sense that you're now alone to have to figure this out. Hopefully one of the most important takeaway messages you're going to get from today's program is that we are all here for you, although this is a program that provides information to you and some thoughts and of what you can do. It also is a program that wants to link you back to services that you can access, that you can have discussions ongoing with our staff at Cancer Care, with our oncology social workers, about these very questions that you raised today in more depth in terms of, so what do I actually do, and what are the steps I go through, and what does that resume look like, and all of those details, and how do I actually talk to my employer? That's really important, or how do I, in a support group, people often will talk about these issues as well, or with an individual counselor. So most importantly, as we're concluding our program today, I don't want anyone to think that you're alone now in having to figure all this out. You're now part of this, all of us, to some extent, wanting to be of help to you, and to know that you can call us any time, and we are happy to help you to think through this in more detail, and really in great detail about how you want to proceed in your workplace, the questions you may have, the questions that may have been prompted from today's program. So I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day, and I also remind you that we have a number of programs coming up, but in terms of the MPM series, we have a program on that's really important on helping children and teens cope with MPM in the family. So that's another workshop that you might be interested in, and it's on May 21st. Again, I want to wish you all a very fine day, and please do call us at 1-800-813-HOPE with any further questions or concerns you may have. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may disconnect. Have a wonderful day.